Oh, only one speaker's working? Okay. Okay. I have been told that only one speaker's working, so everybody over here gets to hear really well, and everybody over there is going to be like we can't, yeah, going to be reading lips. I am a sign language interpreter. If anybody over there can't hear, I'll be happy to sign the whole class not. I actually led a deaf ministry, and I had a, this is crazy, I had a small group where I had hearing and deaf individuals in it, and so I was teaching the lesson while signing, but they're two different languages, actually. Oh, wow. ASL is a completely different word order and different language, and I remember walking out of this feeling schizophrenic, you know? So, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, right? But the real title for me would be sex, drugs, and show tunes. I'm a, my undergraduate degree is in musical theater vocal performance, so I am a Broadway show tunes girl, at least, yeah, at one time, dancing and singing. This is such an important topic, right? These are the areas that I specialize in. So I'm a sex therapist and a chemical dependency counselor. I would say probably three-quarters of my clients come to me for one of those two things. But then I definitely get to work with people about any other number of things, grief, anxiety, depression, and so on. So it's just a huge need, right? And I am really hoping we have time for the time we need for questions. I put questions at the beginning, the end of each section, so before the break and then at the end. So go ahead and hold them. We will get there. I am going to be moving through a lot of material. This is about 30 hours of material condensed into about an hour and a half. So if that gives you an indication. And I, the main thing I could tell you is at the end I show the resources that I would suggest as far as my material. You can go on for the Ransomed Journey, which would be about drugs and alcohol and behavioral addictions. My website, The Ransomed Journey, all one word, ransomed with a D. The Ransomed Journey is the blog on there is the beginning of the book. The book is supposed to be ready in about 6 months. Let's pray about that. It's a book on couples recovery for addiction. And so I work a lot with addiction. I work a lot with sexuality. We do have both our books over here. The Art of Intimate Marriage is for married couples. Redeemed Sexuality is for campus singles, teens, and parents. And I'm going to be referring to some of that material today. We so although we're going to be covering quite a bit, if you need to take some time, I do have a radio show. It's all podcasted on my website. You can go listen to class after class after class. There's hours and hours and hours of material on the Art of Intimate Marriage is my website. And it's got hours of it's the title of the website is Marriage, but actually it's got all the singles material on there as well because I'm just not going to create another website. And so all of the podcasts for singles and parents are on there as well. And there's going to be more. I just, yeah. In my spare time, yeah. If you walk out of with any thought in your mind, I hope this is the one you walk out with.
Yeah. Amen.
Amen.
I mean, we could stop right now because this is the most important thing about anything we're going to talk about today. God made us, and he knows what we need. And he loves us, and he loves us, and he loves us. He made us, and he knows what we need. He made our bodies physically. He made every single cell in your body. And it's just, as we look at all of the things we're going to talk about today, please ground what we're talking about in this. We tend to only talk about sex and drugs in the context of sin. And that's what we do as a church, and we have to change that. I can't emphasize that enough. But the reality is sexuality and the enjoyment of what we take in, drugs, not drugs, but drink and food, are good things. God made our bodies, and he made those things to be enjoyable. God made sex to be good. He, you know, some of you are married, but many of you are not. And we don't tell this to our teens and our singles and our campus students, but we should be. God made sex to be good. God made sex to be good. God made food and drink to be enjoyed. So he made the consumption of stuff to be something enjoyable. And so what we do is we tend to go, don't do that less. But we forget this part of the message, that actually these things in and of themselves are good and godly. Now, what do we do with that? Because the reality is pleasure is God's idea. Let me emphasize that enough. I'm picking it off because I want you to read the rest. Pleasure is God's idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is not Satan's idea. Yeah. Pleasure is God's idea. He wants us to experience pleasure and enjoyment. Satan is the master of deceit. He is the father of lies, and he takes everything that is good that we just talked about, and he twists it just enough to mess it up.
Yeah.
Just enough to make it ugly and yucky, right? When he lies, he speaks his native language because he's a liar and he's the father of lies. So these things in and of themselves are good. Satan takes it and goes, just enough. Sometimes a lot, he twists it. But sometimes all he has to do is just slightly tweak it and it feels anything but good. Okay, so the body, okay, remember he made our body. The body is not made for sexual immorality. Literally, that's why the scriptures say that when we sin against the body, it's even more damaging. Drugs and sex are the greatest areas to sin against our body. Well, there's others too, but those are big, addiction and sexuality. And the body that God made wasn't intended to do certain things. It just literally wasn't made. So then when we get involved in those things, it literally messes with God's creation. Okay, this is an example on alcohol. Do not gaze at wine when it's red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it goes down smoothly. In the end, it bites like a snake and poisons like a viper. So again, that twisting, that taking of something good that gets twisted because of Satan, because of our sin, it ends up something that's good poisoning us, right? So again, grounding everything we're going to look at in that, there is God created these things to be good. Satan twists it and he says, come here, come here, come here, come here, and wants us to have the twisted version, as if the good version isn't good enough. So come here, come here, come here. Just exactly like you did with Eve. Oh, you know, God just doesn't want you to know good from evil. You know, he just, right? He twists God's words to say just slightly different and draws us. And we don't realize that it's poison because it sparkles. You know, it's sparkly. What's that? Bug's Life, when the bug is flying around and then he's like, the light, you know, right? It's so beautiful. You know, all of these things, well, actually there is beauty in them. Because why? God made them to be good. So it's sparkly because God made it cool, right? Sex is beautiful. God made it really cool. It's sparkly. And so initially, though, the misuse of it goes down smoothly. You know, it feels good. It's enjoyable. But in the end, it bites and it poisons. All other sins a person commits are outside the body. Whoever sins sexually sins against their own body. And God, so this isn't like a bad you. That's not why I'm including the scripture. This is a God going, I didn't create your body for that. I made you. I have all these great plans for you. And this isn't one of them. I didn't make your body to be used that way. Okay, so it's important. Ground it in the heart of God. He loves us. He made us. He wants to enjoy. He made pleasure. He wants us to enjoy pleasure. How do we do that in a way that's God-honoring? Well, this is one of the things that comes up. So this is the Thessalonians. They refuse to love the truth and so be saved. For this reason, God sends them a powerful delusion so that they believe the lie. We have to be grounded in God's truth. We have to be deeply grounded in the word and in the truth and in the knowledge of who God is so that we don't end up believing the lie, the lure, the slightly twisted version that Satan gives. They exchanged the truth about God for a lie. They didn't think it worthwhile. Yeah. to retain the knowledge of God. So God gave them over to a depraved mind so that they do what ought not to be done. Now, this is about sexuality in Romans, but it's honestly about all sin, right? But notice what he's pointing out. They didn't retain the knowledge of God. Our knowledge of who God is protects the enjoyment of the pleasurable things God's put in our lives. If we stay grounded in his character and in his heart, it will guide our use of these pleasurable things. Knowing God can guide and direct our sexuality and our sensuality. So sensuality is all the stuff that we do that is pleasurable. That's literally, biblically what the word means. So our knowing him, our knowledge of him can guide all of that. This is material literally straight out of both of our books on sexuality. Psalm 107, some sat in darkness in the deepest gloom, prisoners suffering in iron chains, for they had rebelled against the words of God and despised the counsel of the Most High. So that's the rejecting the knowledge of God, right? So he subjected them to bitter labor. I mean, it bites like a viper, right? They stumbled and there was no one to help. Then they cried to the Lord in their trouble and he saved them from their distress. This is the promise of God. Many of all of us have not followed that plan of God to guide and guard our sexuality and our sensuality in some fashion. But this is his promise. He brought them out of darkness and the deepest gloom and broke away their chains. Again, it affects the body. These sins hugely affect the body and it chains the body. And he says, I will break those chains. Let them give thanks to the Lord for his unfailing love and his wonderful deeds for men, for he breaks down gates of bronze and cuts through bars of iron. These things, these areas of our life can feel very like, I have no idea how to get out of it. It's so consuming. It just, the negative versions of sexuality and consumption of things. And that God can promise freedom. And so that's just important. As we look at a zillion different details today, remember his promise of freedom. He created these things to be enjoyed. He created pleasure. How do we enjoy his beauty and not be chained to those things? Right? So there's the balance. And this is just a compilation of a few different scriptures. I understand well your experience. I hear the cry of the needy, afflicted, and broken. Come to me. I am your refuge. I am safe. I will remake what is broken. I will give you reason to trust and then to love, and I will remake your joy. This may be a difficult topic for you because of how much you feel like it's gotten messed up in your life. These things we're going to talk about today. What God promises is that he will remake our joy. He will bring us to a new territory, a new place, a new land when we retain the knowledge of God. So the reality is sometimes we're not really quite sure then where's the issue? Where's the line? When does this become a problem? It's sometimes hard to tell. So I want to spend a little bit of time just defining it and in actually quite a bit of detail because when is something recreationally enjoyable and when is it an addiction? Where is the line? Let me tell you, in the field of addictive care, we don't know. There are zillion, everybody thinks they know. Actually, that's the problem. Everybody is sure that their definition of the line is the correct definition. So it's just vital to understand that sometimes you'll be talking to a professional this is exactly the way. I just don't think that's accurate. I think there are many different approaches to dealing with some of these challenges. However, most of the time when we sit down with somebody to help us, we can figure out where the line is for us individually, from this is enjoyable to now I've crossed over into maybe, and actually this is it. There's not this like, here's the line. I'm enjoying something and now I'm crossing over it until I'm in full-blown addiction. No. It's this slow progression. Remember, he says it goes down smoothly? So it's not actually a line. It's like we know in James 1 that we're enticed that, you know, by his own desires, a man is drawn away and enticed. That word's really important. And then he sins, and sin gives birth to death. We don't pay attention to the enticement. We pay attention to the sin and the death. But the first part of that verse is vital. He was drawn away by his desires, and he was enticed. So what are the desires? What are the enticements? What is that thing, that drug, that sexual activity? What is it doing for you? What are the pulls? And that's one of the biggest things, is we want to go, this is good, and this is good, and this is bad. But there's a lot of stuff in between recreation to addiction. And so sometimes there isn't such a clear line. Drugs. I've never seen the point of them myself. Why do we go, huh? Why?
Because that looks like our house on the weekend.
Right. There's all the alcohol and the nicotine. So he's got some, yeah, these are all the legal drugs. And he's commenting on illegal drugs. I don't see the point of them myself. Right? He has enough, so he doesn't need to see the point of them. There are many different types of addiction. So again, under defining, there's drugs and alcohol addictions. There's a lot of different thoughts on behavioral addictions. Actually, somebody literally said to me last night, those other things are not addictions. Let's talk about that. I have all kinds of thoughts. In our literature, the behavioral addictions are gambling, shopping, food, and so on. The only one in the DSM, like I've mentioned, is gambling. And then there's sex addiction. So that's just some of them. Honestly, I could do a few pages here. Almost all of them involve this part of the brain, the amygdala, which is dopamine is the primary drug involved in what you call the dopamine reward system, that says, this is good, this is good, this is good. And all drugs and alcohol affect that message in the brain. This is good, this is good. In other words, the more you do them, the more brain says, you need this to feel good, and so the addictive cycle begins. So the dopamine reward system, where the amygdala, which of course is connected, which we've talked about before, to emotion and to the process of addiction. And so we know that food addiction, I just stuck that one in here, because it's one of many, activates this system. So do drugs and alcohol. So does gambling. All of the addictive processes get involved with this part of the brain. Just again, to explain what they are, this is how it's defined in the DSM, that big old thick book I showed you. Taking larger or longer amounts than intended. In other words, more of a substance, or doing it for a longer amount of time than you intend. So I'm going to go just gamble for 30 minutes and you're there for 4 hours. I'm just going to have one drink and I have four. So taking larger or longer amounts than intended, unsuccessful desire to cut down. I've tried to control it. I've tried 4 or 5 or 6 different times and it's not working. Spending a lot of time trying to get it, trying to obtain it, trying to get money to do it. A lot of time in recovery. That would be like with alcohol. A lot of hours with drugs, the detoxing. So a lot of times obtaining, using, and then recovering. The feeling of craving, that's been in and out of the DSM diagnoses. And then it affects the ability to fulfill life, jobs, school, parenting. That the use continues even though it's causing huge amounts of problems. That important activities are given up, relationships are given up. And even though there's physical hazards and psychological problems, continuing to use. This applies to all of the addictive diagnoses. The idea of tolerance, which is where I have to, one drink gets the buzz, but now I need two drinks to get the buzz, now I need three drinks to get the buzz, that's called tolerance, where you have to have more and more in order to feel the effect, or the euphoria, or the relaxation. Whatever the effect is, you do that more and more until. Withdrawal are the physiological symptoms when you stop, when you're waiting, when you haven't done it for an hour, 5 hours, 3 days. And actually, all of the behavioral addictions, when you speak with individuals, which I do, they'll talk about, it's not like a it's not like a the shaking that alcohol. So alcohol has a very physiological withdrawal where the hands shake and or hangovers, right? Those are withdrawal symptoms. With the behavioral addictions, it's kind of an irritation. It's a plan. It's on the mind. The body is a little agitated. So actually, the body will still give very similar signals, even with the behavioral addictions. So there are 10 different areas, different substance areas on addiction. And so the addictive part of the DSM is quite large. And like I said, it's very involved in the reward system. We are figuring out, is it genetics or is it a predisposition? And again, here's another list. And the reason why they're not included is because we just don't have a lot of research on them. But we do know that suicide is accompanied to, this is substance abuse disorders, that a third of those who commit suicide are involved. So there's a, you know, we've been talking about depression and anxiety and suicide. Well, that's, and I don't even think that number is correct. I think it's actually higher than that. So the most addictive substances are the legal ones, alcohol, nicotine, and caffeine. Caffeine is very addictive and has very strong withdrawal symptoms. Look at this chart. These are the addictive drugs. Which is the largest? That's just one. I've actually seen it where the alcohol piece is much larger. It depends on the research study. We tend to go, ooh, that meth thing, that hydrocodone thing. And hydrocodone is the green, the next large one. We have an opiate crisis, right? And it's all over the newspapers. But what's our real crisis?
Alcohol.
And what's on all of the headlines? The opiates. And it's terrible because the death rate is so high, right? So death, much more common with these drugs. But the actual rate of how many people are using and abusing a drug, alcohol is way higher than everything else. It's very destructive. So it's just important that we put it all in perspective. Now, of all of the what you call illicit drugs, which would mean the ones you're not supposed to take at all that are illegal, which now we've changed that in California, the highest number one is marijuana. This one doesn't show it. Let me show it here. Marijuana is the number one illicitly drug used drug. The second is prescription drugs. Look at the difference. That's how much. And I'll show you something on that in just a minute. But this is what's important. This is alcohol dependency is the blue. And this is people who are just in the general population. All of these people are addicted to drugs. The red are people addicted to drugs. But the blue are people who have an alcohol dependency who are addicted to drugs. In other words, they're doing alcohol and drugs. So how problematic is alcohol? Like huge. And we have to pay attention to this. In the Bible, it's really clear. It is not a bad thing. Jesus made water into wine. Okay, so in and of itself, it is not a bad thing. But the power it has for destruction is huge. So same with sexuality. That's my picture. I was driving to a wedding in Oregon, and I saw a couple signs. And I went, so I pulled over to the side of the road and I took this picture. And I was like, okay, I'm sorry. This is really funny. Weed, next three exits. Right? It's super available right now, right? So I have people who have barely had it under control. Barely. They're doing it and it's problematic. Barely. Barely had it under control for the last 10, 20, 30 years. Who have tanked. This is March. It became legal in January. I have a marriage that's over. I have somebody in rehab because it became legal in January. This is not a small thing. But remember, what's the biggest drug? Alcohol. So we need to look at all of it. It's all dangerous. It's all problematic when it's not used for the right kind of enjoyment, when that progressive stepping over the line happens. Just so you know, yes, there are withdrawal symptoms. Oh my gosh, my very loved family will question me on this. Actually, my oldest majorly questions me on this, and I'm like, I'm sorry. But the world's leaders have put this in a very big book called the DSM, and it's called Cannabis Withdrawal. Now, yes, It is predominantly when there is heavy and prolonged use. That means daily over months. Somebody that's using it very regularly over a certain length of time. And these are the symptoms: irritability, anger, aggression, nervousness, anxiety, sleep difficulty, insomnia, decreased appetite, weight loss, restlessness, depressed mood, abdominal pain, shakiness, sweating, fevers, chills, headache. Yes. So we can't be addicted to cannabis. That is incorrect. You can, with heavy and prolonged use, you can become addicted and you have withdrawal symptoms. But actually, most of the time, what I see with those I work with is not a physical withdrawal symptoms, it's the emotional. Meaning they've been using cannabis or alcohol or whatever their drug of choice is to moderate their emotions. So when they stop using it, emotionally, things become very difficult. So the withdrawal symptoms might not be physical like all of these are, but they are emotional and they're big time. So what do we know in the scriptures about wine? I think we could apply this to all of them. This is, wine is a mocker and beer is a brawler. Whoever is led astray by them is not wise. Do not join those who drink too much wine, for drunkards become poor in drowsiness, clothes them in rags. And here's the one I already said, woe, strife, needless, listen to the words on that. Who has woe, sorrow, strife, and needless bruises and bloodshot eyes? Those who linger over wine, it goes down smoothly in the end, it bites off. Right? I mean, okay, so it's got all kinds of these physiological symptoms, and all of them, all of the behavior, especially the drugs and alcohol, have all these physiological things. This is what happens to the body. This is a normal to a fatty to cirrhosis. I have a family member whose right now liver looks like the third. My grandfather died with that. My uncle died with that. So it's heavily in my family line. I have major drinkers on both sides of my family. So it affects our body. And what? Who made the body? God made the body, right? And he did a beautiful job. We are fearfully and wonderfully made. And this stuff, when we progressively go over that line, messes up the physical body. I'm just throwing this in because sometimes people don't understand. See that little teeny shot? So this would be like tequila. A little shot of tequila is the same as a beer. So you have one shot, one beer, and you are already impaired. So this is why, and I don't mean this to, this is all over every person that works in this field. You have one drink and you're already impaired. You are not over the legal limit.
Right.
But that doesn't mean you're safe on all levels. You have a second one. This is for everybody, one impairs. It doesn't matter. We get this thing of, oh, I'm bigger and I can handle more. One impairs because it changes the ability to hit the pedal. It actually slows down. Same thing, so one hit. We're still studying the difference between, say, they've got some studies out now in the last couple of years where they compare alcohol, how it affects the motor control, and cannabis, how it affects the motor control, and they both affect the motor control the same. Meaning the ability to hit that brake when a car comes out and you're driving is the same. The thing is, the difference is the car accidents are a lot worse under alcohol because people are driving faster under alcohol, and they drive really slow when they're doing weed. So actually, the number of car accidents is not nearly the same. That doesn't mean that the same issues to the body aren't happening. Okay, so just, I had somebody who said to me that, he said, okay, I'm going to moderate my drinking. I looked online and it said four drinks in an hour and I'll be fine. And I was like, actually, it's four drinks over a four-hour period. And he was like, oh. So we need to have our information correct. Okay? So, right. All right. I'm going to show you some pictures here of different drugs and alcohol drugs. And I just want to help you be aware that for some people these are triggering. If you have a background in the use of drugs, just looking at the pictures can actually be triggering. It's okay to close your eyes. All right, you can just listen to this next section. Hallucinogens, that's LSD, PCP, ecstasy, we call them acid blotters, boomers, California sunshine, and a zillion other names. Sugar cubes, tabs, trips, okay, that's one type. Amphetamines, these are synthetic compounds like ephedrine, that they're stimulants to the central nervous system and they increase attention alertness, but they also create a sense of euphoria. And so these are, amphetamines like Adderall, Ritalin, and like meth. These are some more. This is ecstasy. So ecstasy comes in all kinds of different little pills with lots and lots of different names. Cranks, Bennies, Uppers, Adderall, Meth, Crystal Meth, Ice, Glass, Speed, Tina, Biker's Coffee, people use Ritalin, Concerta, Cat, Cot, Crank, Goob, Ecstasy. Okay, so it comes in a lot of forms. Amphetamines are used big time. I have to tell you something. I am a drug and alcohol specialist. I don't recognize these things. half the time, people, I think I mentioned this, they walk in and they're stoned and I can't smell it. My kids tease me because it smells like a skunk and I don't realize I'm smelling marijuana. So, but you don't have to necessarily know what these things are to know how to help people and how to deal with it yourself. So, marijuana, it comes in many, many different forms. You can smoke it, chew it, eat it, and then people use it for the hallucinogenic effect, for the intoxicating effect, and for medicinal purposes. Cocaine comes in, it's powerful, it's a stimulant, like the other stimulants, but it's very powerful because it targets the dopamine receptors. So cocaine just very much gets involved in the dopamine reward system. You can do it in powder form, you can inject it, you can snort it intranasally, and you can put it under the tongue. It can be converted into crystals, and that's crack cocaine. So we tend to think cocaine's the big one, right? But if you'll notice on that graph, where was cocaine? It was actually a pretty small one. It's hugely problematic when people become addicted to it, which happens pretty quickly. What about prescription drugs? Well, we know it's huge. Non-medical use of prescription drugs and the ingestion is the ingestion of prescription-type psychotherapeutic drugs without a prescription. When someone takes that legal prescription that was given to them for medication and they use it in a way that wasn't prescribed. And these are, they have farming parties where, this is like today. This happened last night or tonight, where individuals go into their parents, their grandparents, somebody's, and they just grab a bunch of pill bottles and they take them to a party and they dump all of the pills into a big bowl. It's called pharmaceuticals. It's kind of a joke on that word. And they just take a handful. So all of these different drugs are in the bowl and they just take a handful, not even knowing what's in there. So, and this is what they look like. So lots of different names. Now, this specifically, though, is on opiates. So opiates is like you think of, like morphine and opium, like we think of China and the opium wars. Well, there's a lot of different versions of it, and so all the painkillers are opiates. Well, most of them are opiates, the ones that are problematic. Well, they can all be problematic. But oxycodone, hydrocodone are the big ones right now in the opiate crisis. They lower pain. But the addiction potential is huge. So oxycodone and hydrocodone are the big ones here in San Diego right now. They're synthesized. It's a synthesized version of opium. So what happens is they came out because they were such good pain relievers in 96, and then the abuse picked up big time after that. So OxyContin is involved in half of the... There's 4 million episodes of narcotic abuse, and half of those are OxyContin. I think that actually crosses over into hydrocodone. So what else do we have? These are the benzos. So this is Xanax and Ativan and Klonopin. Yeah, so huge levels of abuse also with these. Again, this is still under prescription drugs. And then we have the one that we sold for years. So I guess who created heroin? Bayer. Bayer Aspirin created heroin. Morphine was purified in 1805. The hypodermic needle was created in 1853. Bayer invented heroin in 1898. In 1913, they go, oops, and they stop selling it for production. And in 16, they synthesize, a new one. It's got a nicer name. It's called oxycodone. And the FDA takes a long time to approve it, but then there it goes again, right? So here's actually literally a picture of Bayer. See, it says Bayer on the top of there, heroin. Oops, right? Okay, so those are the drugs, right, of addiction. And these are behavioral addictions. So there's food addiction, and I just put this picture in there because it helps you understand. you have the same interaction with the brain. Often for many, it's a lifelong battle. It numbs. It's used to numb uncomfortable feelings. So, what do you hear here?
I like it.
It's used to numb uncomfortable feelings. What are you hearing there? It's the same, a big chunk of the same reason why people use drugs. Give me the chocolate and nobody gets hurt, right? Gambling. What do you see when people are addicted to gambling? You see very secretiveness. You see trouble controlling. They gamble even when they don't have the money. Family and friends are worried, right? You see that same pattern on around a behavioral addiction. So this is the diagnosis for sexual addiction. Excessive time consumed. This is not in the DSM, but it is used big time in the psychology community. Excessive time consumed by sexual fantasies and urges, repetitive engaging in sexual fantasies, urges in response to dysphoric mood states. We're going to talk about this more in the second half. Repetitive engaging. Oh, I put that in there twice. Repetitive but unsuccessful efforts to control. Oh, yeah. One says in response to mood states, and the other one says in response to stress. In other words, emotion. Last one, repetitively engaging in that behavior despite the health risks. So again, what does that sound like? What are the different ways where sexual addiction becomes problematic, either through compulsive masturbation, through the use of cyber sex, pornography, sex with consenting adults, so this is multiple partners, cyber sex, telephone sex, adult entertainment, so this is the strip clubs and so on. So sexual addiction, it acts very similarly to all of these others, where it does the same thing with the dopamine reward system, and you see the same process of I need it. I work with this a bit. This comes in my door a lot because I specialize in sexuality and addiction, so sexual addiction comes in my door a lot. And it honestly looks almost exactly the same as somebody who's an alcoholic, as far as in the process of what it's done to their lives, why they use it, and how to treat it. There are a lot of different approaches on what to do, right, in the psychological community. There's the disease model, which is the 12-step AA model, that you have a disease and you have it for the rest of your life. Many different thoughts on that. Genetic factors, I already said that. Cultural factors, is it a learned behavior? Is it something that in cultures that balance it right, they do it right, and cultures that abuse it, that's the problem, right? Is it a learned behavior within families and cultures? Is it people use it to cope? Or is it just something that's a habit? So that's a learned behaviors would be one of the views on how you approach addiction. That it's you got to deal with life's stressors and its problems, and so one of the groups here called CRAFT uses this model. Is it an emotion regulation in a trauma? Actually, the attachment model would approach it that way. Is it a medical issue? That would be a little bit more along the lines of the disease model. If I took time to ask all of you which ones you think this is, you would tend towards one of these views. All of us tend towards one. In my experience, all of the above is the answer on what approach works. You know, what is the issue? In all honesty, it's usually all of the above. So what do you do? On the road to recovery, what do you do? Well, you have to figure out the generational patterns, the family background, in my experience. You've got to understand that there's generations affecting the choices that you make. The way families deal with stress and emotion, it comes down. Is it genetic? I don't know that that's genetic. I would call those, you know, learned behaviors. But it definitely comes down. And so the use of substances within those generations. Yes, there's a lack of self-control. And so learning, we know this biblically, learning self-control is a part of it. But you'll notice it's just one part. You've got, if people aren't in good intimate relationships, you've got to up their relationship quality. You know, or their background, they were in really poor relationships when they were growing up. You've got to deal with that trauma background, that family background. If people don't have purpose and motivation and meaning in their life, if they're not open with hurts, with doubts, with fears, with weaknesses and wrongs, if they have unresolved stuff in relationships, so this is the road. It's not just stopping drinking, stopping doing the drug. It's not just sobriety. It is then after, okay, I've been detoxed, I've been sober for this amount of time, and then the road has to include dealing with all of the underlying factors. So The thing I tell people is you have to have a process of recovery. You have to have a really clear plan. Who are you going to call? Okay? Do you have a sponsor? Do you have a mentor? Do you have accountability? Do you have somebody who, I'm not talking the accountability like beat you over the head type accountability. Somebody that you call and say, I'm pulled. Like before you even use, do you call and say, help me? So this is very well set up in the 12-step program. All of the 12-step programs do a really great job of sponsorship. We should excel at this in the body. So there are a lot of different programs. There's 12 Steps, there's Smart Recovery, I call mine Ransom Journey, there's Broken Chains here in San Diego. Tim Summerlin has done an excellent job with his work on In Motion. We are hoping that's going to be coming to San Diego soon. Tim is an elder in Denver, and he's a therapist. I tell people, you have to be, if you really want to recover, you need to be in group therapy, you need to be in individual therapy, and you need to be in family therapy. All of the above. And often, all they do is number one. Maybe number two. Rarely number three. And the need for it is phenomenally high. Again, what are all the things underlying whatever the use is? So in that process, identifying triggers, finding, and when you identify what triggers you to use, well, what do you need to do to replace it, right? You sweep the house out, but you got to put good things back in the house or the demons are just going to come pouring back in. So what are you going to do to replace it? What are the scriptures that you need? Make sure you share it with somebody that you're accountable. Dig in and find out why. Make sure you have, and this sounds negative, a really good relapse plan. That means when you relapse, what are you going to do so you don't spiral big time? It's one of the biggest things I do when I'm working with people is putting together. And I do a lot of couples work. And it's really hard for a partner when I'm sitting there working with their spouse on how to relapse because there's so much trauma involved in their use. But actually, a really good relapse plan makes a huge difference to the process of recovery. And the reality is, it's important to realize that early recovery is about 1 to 3 years. Early. You're still in the early stages, 1 to 3 years. You're in middle recovery, 3 to 5 years. That means you've been sober, or whatever version of sobriety is 3 to 5 years. So late recovery is called maintenance, is 5 years and up. So it's, we tend to go, oh, wow, you know, it's been a whole year. And a year is awesome. I'm not saying it's not, but we just have to realize that the vulnerability at early recovery is super high because most people don't make it beyond the year in their process multiple times. They'll do like 6 months, they'll do 9 months, they'll do a year, and on the date, I've made a year, they do something. So it's just important to support people through those early processes because those are super vulnerable times. How do you respond as disciples? Speak the truth. Just do it in love, in compassion. If you are a rescuer, like I have to take care of these people, you could be enabling them in their use. Nobody else is helping them. It's a huge, let me tell you, this comes in my door all the time, the rescuers. And I love, I don't have this scripture here, but okay, so imitate God. We have the parable of the lost son, right? He goes off and he's eating pig's food. And it says he began to be in need. And what does it say? And no one gave him anything. And then what did he do? He said, my father's servants have it better than I do. There is a time for doing nothing to help someone. In fact, sometimes when you do something, you are harming them. Some of you here have come to ask me about your kids, and I really appreciate my kid is, I've shared this before, suicidal, and we've said no drugs, and they're doing drugs in the home. What do? Because if we say he can't be in the home, he might commit suicide. Those are really, really tough decisions. But sometimes, in order to help people get to the point where they say, help me, God, they have to have nothing. I'm not saying you have to hit rock bottom. That's actually, that thinking isn't correct. People don't have to hit rock bottom to recover. But sometimes people have to get to the point where they're just them and God, and they say, oh my gosh, I'm eating pig's food. And I need my father. And I am willing to go walk back towards him. And then look at God's response. While he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. Now, this isn't a perfect analogy to how to deal with drugs and alcohol, but it certainly shows the heart of God. Is he gave that son that money and let him go squander it. I'm not saying let your kids go get involved in drugs. Please don't take it that far. I'm just saying there is a point to which we have to stop what we think is love when it actually isn't, when we're doing the rescuing. At what point do you stop helping people? I don't know. Because your situation is different than his situation, which is different than her situation. So get very careful. And let me tell you, everybody's going to tell you a different answer. Make sure you're dealing with the right issue. If you're dealing with, you think it's an addiction issue and it's actually depression, it's important to figure out, right? Because let me tell you, it's a chicken or the egg thing with that. You do need to have healthy boundaries in yourself, in your ministry. There need to be consequences and expectations. That's the heart of discipline in Hebrews, right? And we need to be, there's this balance, right? Discipline and being a messenger of reconciliation, I think it's all the same thing. And so we just need to be in great prayer and seek a lot of input about ourselves and about those that we're helping in the process of recovery. So be imitators of God. All right, we're going to open this for 5 minutes and then take a break. So I know 5 minutes isn't enough, but around just addiction, give me your questions. Yeah, and make them short and brief, by the way.
Pornography.
We're going to get to pornography in the second half. Yeah.
In terms of addiction, if you're not sure you're addicted...
Right. Are you asking for yourself or your friend that we all don't know about? Sorry, go ahead. I was just teasing you. Go ahead, ask your question.
If you're not sure you're addicted, say alcohol...
Yeah.
Because you say that there's a smooth...
Right, where's the smooth? So this is what I typically do. So, let me do a quick answer. Okay. I get somebody in, I don't know if I have a problem, or my mom thinks I have a problem, my spouse thinks I have a problem, and I go, oh, do you want to know if you have a problem? I don't think I have a problem. Okay. Are you curious? I'm a little sneaky.
So
I'm a little manipulative. And I'll go, well, sometimes it helps people to know and to be able to say, I don't have a problem. So we could do an assessment. Do you want to do an assessment? I'm so sneaky. I'm so bad. I am manipulative when it comes to this. And they'll go, well, okay. And then I do a MAST, which is a Michigan alcohol assessment of alcohol use. And all I have to do is show them the number. I ask them a bunch of questions. I show them the number. And anybody that says, my mother thinks I have a problem, my husband thinks I have a problem, almost always shows up. The SAST is the sex addiction one. MAST is alcohol. And DAST is drug. I do one version of those with somebody and they go, oh. And then it's what you call motivational interviewing, where you just give people some information and then you... Honestly, when people are in pre-contemplation, which I'm not even sharing any of this, which means they don't think they have a problem, you have a different approach, which is, let me just give you some information, then you leave it there. Now, when they're living in your home, you have to do a little bit more because you have to have boundaries. But yes, early on, when people don't think they have a problem, they're not going to listen to a lot of the information I'm even sharing with you today. When they're later, farther along, what you call the contemplation and action and so on, these are the different levels of recovery, which we're not even covering today. Then they can take in more information and they can take it more to heart. But initially, sometimes all you do is a little bit of education and then you leave it there. And actually, this is a lot of times what I use, is I'll do a little bit of education with this right there, or this. So I'll give them a little bit of, this is when they first come into my office, we do that MAST. The guy that said 4 drinks, I actually showed him this and he was like, oh. So, sometimes I leave it there. I'm not confrontive. I just give them the information and then I go on. Okay, other questions. Sorry, let me get back because I don't want it to be confusing too much, right? All right, one more. Any others? Yes.
Sometimes people will say that I'm judgmental if I suggest these things.
I know.
How do we talk?
I would just ask. So does that feel judgmental? Tell me what feels judgmental.
Okay.
And let them say it. They say, that helps me. If giving this information feels judgmental, I get it. And so you let me know when you'd like that. So I think a lot of times when we want to go towards the AA model, which is confront. Sometimes actually I would recommend validating. Oh, that feels judgmental. Tell me about it. All right, we're going to take a break, and I'm, you know, for 5 minutes just today because we have so much to cover, and then we'll go into sexuality. So 5 minutes, 5 minutes. Thank you, actually. Yeah. Pie chart, yeah. Oh, sorry.
I want to apologize, John.
Great. You still owe me a PowerPoint, just so you know.
I do? I didn't send it to you?
Nope.